Hello, and welcome to Speaking of College of Charleston. I'm Matthew Kressler, Associate Professor from the Religious Studies Department, and on today's episode, I'm speaking with Maudie Crabtree, Associate Professor of African American Studies, about her new book, My Soul is a Witness, The Traumatic Afterlife of Lynching, published by Yale University Press this January. The book is an intimate look at the afterlife of lynching through the personal stories of Black victims and survivors in the South who lived through and beyond its trauma. And first off, I just want to thank Maudie for being in conversation with me. This is such a powerful, it's hard to come up with the right words because it's powerful and beautiful. It's troubling and disturbing. It's deeply insightful. It's provocative. And I'm just really grateful to be in conversation with you about it. So thank you.
Well, thank you for doing this with me. I'm really glad that you're the person I get to talk to about my book.
So I told you this before, and I'll say it again. I have a thing about first lines of books. I love to see how authors, how writers kind of invite, make the first impression and invite readers in. And I was particularly struck by the way you open your introduction, so the way you open your book, particularly because it, you know, struck me as a really interesting place to start, specifically a book on the trauma of lynching and memory. So I was wondering if we could maybe begin the conversation with you reading for us that opening paragraph, and then I have a kind of question I'd love to ask you about it.
Sure. The artist has much to offer the scholar. Beauty, pleasure, and certainly a dexterity with language and sound and images, but also a gift for reflecting the world back onto us and revealing the nuances and mysteries of the human condition. Art, the good stuff anyway, compels us to pause and think more deeply. It demands the self-reflection that prompts us to ask who we are and what we can become. And it urges us to abandon stale questions and imagine new ways of seeing the world. Much of my own writing has been refracted through art, especially as I worked through this project on the traumatic legacies of lynching in the U.S. South. A turn of a phrase in a Yusuf Komunyakaa poem provided a flash of insight into the impulse to trap painful memories inside and the costs of carrying the burden of that pain to the grave. A scene from a Toni Morrison novel prompted me to wonder if a place, a tree, a courthouse, the land itself, can really hold the memories of the dead. A blues lyric and the slow bending of a blue note from a Lightnin' Hopkins song made me feel, just for a moment, the desperation of searching for relief when faced with the limits of otherworldly justice.
Ooh, thank you so much for that. So I am friends with you. I know your work well, and I knew that this book was about the trauma of lynching, not just kind of as acts of violence, but as kind of memory carried in the body, in the soul. And so then when I read that first line, right, the artist has much to offer the scholar, you know, beauty, pleasure. Those are words that I, you know, was kind of surprised to read as the opening line. And I was wondering if you could speak more about why you chose to open this book on the afterlife of lynching, you know, this book on history and memory of horror and trauma, with a meditation on art and beauty, which I thought was a really powerful way to begin.
Well, there are a couple reasons for this. I think the first is that so much of my work is really refracted through the work of artists, especially other writers, but also visual artists, musicians, and other folks. And so I wanted to pay homage to the people who inspire me, who provide me with a lot of the ideas at the core of my work. And the other part of this, too, is that I think on a book about lynching, which necessarily is going to be a book about violence, is necessarily going to be a disturbing book to read, I wanted to prepare readers for the other things that I'm doing in this book, because as much as this is a book about lynching, it's really a book about Black Southerners, how Black Southerners made it through and beyond lynching, and the real beauty that is revealed in such a study. You know, when you're actually asking a slightly different question from what we tend to ask about lynching, we tend to ask, why did people do this? You know, what were the consequences for white and Black Southerners of lynching? And those are all legitimate questions to ask, and that have been asked, I think, and answered quite well by a lot of other scholars. But I wanted to center Black people, I wanted to center the Black cultural tradition, and I wanted to center the grace and beauty that issues forth from Black people, Black communities, and that cultural tradition.
Yeah, and I think that that's one of the things, one of the many things that I love about your book so much is precisely what you were just saying about how you're taking this subject that in some senses, those of us who are awake to the world and our past feel like we know so much about, but giving it to us, inviting us into an entirely different way of approaching that, right? And so actually my second question kind of dovetails very well with that kind of first one, because in the first chapter, so chapter one is titled An Anatomy of a Lynching, there are these two remarkable moments that I don't think I've ever seen anything quite like in a work of history. The chapter is An Anatomy of a Lynching, and you're kind of, to start off the book, breaking down for us kind of how lynching kind of in broad brushstrokes operated in history. So you're breaking down the mobs and the rituals and the myths that defined these horrifying spectacles. In that moment, so as you're doing this and as you're kind of leading us through these really, really difficult, disturbing kind of descriptions of lynching, you have a paragraph break, and then you literally instruct us as readers, breathe. You know, when I was reading it, it was like almost like having you turn to the camera if this were a movie and insisting that we pause and go no further. You even say, like at one point, this is a quote, you say breathe, and then you say, let your eyes lose focus. Let them wander from the page. You know, you're reading this book, you know, I was reading this book, and then you as author telling me, no, you need to stop reading. I don't want you to go any further yet. Which just totally blew me away. And so I was wondering if you could talk, and I think that, again, this kind of like rhymes with that first question about art and the artist and what the artist has to say. But can you talk more about this choice you made as an author and how it connects to the ethics that you are kind of insisting that we take up as readers and that you are taking up as scholar and writer? Because I think that this is a kind of narrative choice, it's an authorial choice, but it's one that's deeply informed by the ethics of your work as a scholar and writer. So,
yeah, the first chapter was a very difficult chapter to write because of the extended descriptions of violence. It was, I imagined, very hard for someone to read as well. And I did get some feedback in one of my book manuscript workshops about how hard chapter one was to get through because of the, not because I was unnecessarily talking about violence, it's kind of unavoidable in a book on lynching, but that it was unrelenting in some ways. And so I wanted those line breaks, those pauses, the instruction to breathe, to be there for the reader and to also recenter the focus away from what the lynch mob did, because that's what those sections that preceded them were talking about. I think it was because the book is really about Black communities in the South. I wanted to talk about Black families, Black communities. I wanted to talk about them again and remind the reader as they were pausing and breathing that that's what this is really about. I had really good advice from Tara Hunter, my mentor at Princeton, who said that you shouldn't be writing for the very worst reader out there. So you don't need to be writing this to convince someone who's the worst person you can imagine, who doesn't think lynching was that bad or needs to see every little bit of gore on the page, and instead to think about what you need to convey about the gravity of this act in order to set the stage for the analysis that you're doing. And so that was also part of that kind of thought process in the writing, was how do I achieve that balance where I am imagining a reader who I want to stay with me, who I don't want to hurt while they're reading, while I also want to not minimize the true harm, the true terror, the true trauma that issued from lynchings.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think to say a little bit more about it, like it just and it's, so this is in chapter one, so you're still early on as a reader, you know, you're still early on in the book. And it almost kind of, I think one of the reasons that it was so striking for me is it almost kind of, not almost, it did insist that this isn't, that you shouldn't engage this book as you perhaps were kind of conditioned to engage it, right? Like that we're conditioned, you know, when we're reading a scholarly work, we're conditioned to kind of, particularly a work of history, to approach it as a kind of text through which we absorb new information, right? That we are learning about, you know, facts, for lack of a better term, right? And it, and those breathe moments really insisted that, like, no, we're not dealing with facts. I mean, we are, but, but like that, what you really, as you were just saying, like what you're really doing is kind of inviting us to inviting us into the lives of these Black families, these survivors often of lynching or the threat of lynching, and inviting us to kind of be with them almost, right? There's a kind of I'm kind of failing for words on it, but it's a kind of meditation. You know, there is a kind of I'm a religious studies scholar, so I'll just go there, right? There is a kind of like spiritual kind of like component to that part of the book, which I thought was really powerful. And you know, for the listeners, this book is part of a series called New Directions in Narrative History. And so I felt like that was a moment in particular among many others where I felt you kind of, in a sense, saying like, you know, inviting us, you know, of course, to think about lynching in particular ways, but also to kind of think about what we're doing as historians or as scholars or as just readers of history. Like you're kind of insisting that we relate to the past in ways that are different than how we're accustomed to. I don't know if you have more thoughts on that, but
because again, there's been wonderful work, wonderful scholarship done, wonderful work by the Equal Justice Initiative in compiling names and numbers, places of where lynchings took place, and that work is absolutely indispensable. I wanted my book to be kind of resting on the foundation of that work and focus on stories, focus on individual people, because individual people's lives are the reason why the numbers matter ultimately, right? And that was something I didn't want to lose. So that's why I wanted to invite the reader into these particular communities and kind of weave those communities, these stories, these families into the book, instead of it being an attempt at like covering every single lynching that happened in the South, which would be impossible, really diving into these stories, because I wanted people to feel the full weight, or as much of the weight as they could carry, of the personal side of these lynchings.
Yeah. And I guess this whole podcast is speaking to listeners, but directing this to the listeners, you know, this is like one of the real gifts of this book, and why I'd really encourage you to read it. The lives that Mari, that you bring to the page, are lives that you really feel like you come to know. And correct me if I'm getting the name wrong. James Pennington, is it James?
Jesse.
Jesse Pennington is one of these people who survives a lynching, escapes to Chicago, and So I kind of get to know him in this early moment in his life. And then later in the book, he shows back up again because he ended up, because he was in Chicago, attending the funeral for Emmett Till. And it was this moment where, you know, if you are familiar with African-American history, you've heard, you know, the funeral of Emmett Till, you know, described in so many ways and so many times. But there was this kind of very human connection where it's this person. I feel like I now know so many of the people that you describe in the book, and I just think that's a real gift, and why, you know, one of the many reasons that I'd encourage people to really pick up My Soul as a Witness and sit with it. So I want to take us to a different moment in the book now, the middle of the book. Again, we're friends, so we've talked about this. So I was going to say, dare I say, maybe both of our favorite chapters, if we have to choose a favorite chapter, which is chapter 3, the title of which is Haunting. And in this chapter, you tell ghost stories, in a sense. You tell ghost stories, but ones that very much challenge the kinds of romanticized ghost stories that you might hear on a kind of ghost tour in downtown Charleston, right? You, and this is a quote from the book, you note that throughout the South, African Americans have told stories about haunted courthouses, inexplicable afflictions, mysterious deaths, and agonized deathbed confessions that resurrected the ghosts of local lynchings. And I just, you know, I was so kind of captivated by this chapter, haunted by this chapter, that I was wondering if you might tell us a ghost story, if you might just choose maybe one of your favorites or one moment that really stands out to you, to give, again, you know, listeners a sense of how this book is, you know, doing something a little different in the ways that we think about lynching and memory.
Yes, the one I'll talk about then is the one that James Reed told me. And the way I even found James Reed is interesting, because I had been working on my dissertation, talking to one of my dissertation committee members, Robert Harris, and he was like, oh, well, you know, my brother-in-law, James Reed, has this ghost story he told me that about a haunted courthouse where a man had been lynched. And so that's how I came across it, was very much kind of by accident. But this is how I describe it, at least in part, in the book. From a second-story window of the small brick courthouse in Pickens County, Alabama, a face etched onto the windowpane peers out onto the tiny town of Carrollton. For the locals, that pane of glass has become the stuff of legend, or, to be more precise, legends. Most explanations for the apparition in the courthouse involve the lynching of a black man. But the differences between black and white memories of the haunting reveal how these disparate memories of the apparition in the window served very different purposes for each community. Growing up in Hattiesburg, Mississippi during the 1940s and 1950s, James Reed heard his great-aunt Maggie Rose Barnett Reed tell all kinds of stories about living in rural Mississippi at the height of Jim Crow. When the extended family came over to visit, they talked about everything from Klan violence to the daily humiliations of segregation. But one story in particular stuck out, a story about a face that would appear in a courthouse window. Reed remembered it this way, quote, "Growing up, my great aunt who raised me used to tell me of a story of a situation that took place back in the, oh, I guess, early 20s, of an African-American being lynched in some part of Alabama, which was actually, it was right across the river. Let's see, Noxubee County is where we were, our family was, and it was right across the river, so it had to be the Tom Bigbee River in Alabama. So whatever is close to Noxubee County in Alabama is where this took place. The story goes, there was this African-American that was allegedly dating a white woman, and he was arrested and killed. And he said that he was not guilty of anything. He hadn't raped. It was a rape situation. They had not raped this woman, but they took him out and killed him anyway. The story goes is that he said, quote, you will see my face in the courthouse window once a month or something to that effect. And according to the way it was told to me, They tried changing out the window and everything, and regardless of the number of times they tried to change out the window, his face would appear as he predicted.
So I have a few things I want to say. The first is that I remember you giving a presentation on this chapter before it was a book chapter, when it was still in progress, and you had an image of that front of the courthouse. And I'm, as you're reading the story, I'm seeing the image. Like, that has never left me. Like, that has stuck with me, that face. So I'm blown away by that. But I also, you know, as you were reading that particular story, I was struck by kind of one of the, I think, signatures of the book, which is that it's a storytelling book, or it's a book where you are allowing kind of or inviting all of these people to tell their own stories. And the way you're doing that is very much, you know, not like what will happen in post-production of this podcast where ums and ands and, you know, coughs are taken out, but you're really attentive to the silences, the pauses, the kind of stop-start nature of these stories. And you know, so not only do you keep them in the book, but you attend to them as kind of moments that demand that we listen, right? Not that they're just kind of like someone who hasn't quite got the words right, but that we can actually learn something about those ellipses, you know, those things that might in a normal text just show up as an ellipsis, right? And so I'm wondering, like, you know, in the, you know, since you read that story and you've brought him into the room, if you could maybe say a little bit about that kind of choice, because I think that that is, again, a kind of distinctive way that you bring these people's lives into our lives through the book.
Yeah, I think it was really important in both the transcription process for oral histories that other people recorded and the transcription process for my own oral histories that I did, to think not just about what they were saying, but how they were saying it. Trauma is something that operates by having some traumatic episode return, often uninvited.
And like a ghost.
Yeah, like a ghost. You never know when it's going to show up. And the ways in which people were recalling stories so often were most easily understood through the framework of, like, what trauma is in terms of psychology, right? Like, what does a post-traumatic stress response look like? And so as much as I was obviously interested in, like, how did the face appear, or what did they do to the windows, or, you know, what did the town do in the aftermath, those details are obviously really important, but also the ways in which people told stories, especially stories that were from their own direct experience, was just as important as what they were saying, really the how they're saying it. And I kind of closed chapter three with a close reading of an interview that Paul Ortiz, who's a historian in Florida, did with Minnie Weston, this black woman in Mississippi in the 1990s through Duke University. And I am very attentive to what she's saying about, you know, lynchings that happened in her family and in her town, but also her reluctance to return to some of those horrific memories, and also the ways in which she was able to compartmentalize those memories from the rest of her life as a way to just continue to live. And that's just as much of the story as what happened to her. Like, how does she come to terms with, or if she can't come to terms with, how does she handle and survive this?
Yeah, and Minnie Weston, along with Jesse Pennington, are two of the people, like the human beings that you kind of bring into our lives through the book that, like, I'm never going to forget. Like, that moment at the end of chapter three is one of my favorites. And I actually, before, I want to transition to another question, but before we leave, I have to chime in as the religious studies professor, because one of the things that I love, and it's throughout the book, but it's especially there in this haunting chapter, is how you let the stories be there and be true and not kind of immediately start to psychoanalyze or, like, offer some kind of explanation of what's actually going on. So you open, you know, and I won't read the passage, but you open chapter three with the story of theodicy, of kind of God kind of coming down through in the form of a tornado to kind of, like, rip through this town where Waco, where there's been a lynching. And you share these stories. And then the last line in this opening part is, or so the stories went, right? Like, as a way of, I hear you saying, like, and I'm not going to comment on, like, whether God actually sent a tornado down, but, like, this is what they say, and, like, we need to hear what they say, right? Which I just love, and again, you know, in I think much of history as a discipline, kind of like if you're not attuned to kind of religious studies scholarship, you might be inclined to be like, well, this is what, you know, they said, but like, let me tell you what's actually going on. And you're just like, you know, this is what they say, and why don't we sit with this?
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, because I'm much less I'm not trained as a historian to figure out which ghosts are real, but also I don't care in a certain way, because I care much more about why the ghosts appear.
Right.
Like, why do they tell the ghost story? And that's a much more interesting question to me than, like, was there, was God's hand
right.
at play in this tornado? Or was the face in the window the face of this man, you know?
Right. So I have two more questions. One is for our students, and one is for me. So this one goes out to all our students. You know, both of us teach classes in African American studies, and I think, you know, and you can you know, share a little bit if you think differently. But you know, I think a lot of our students come to African American studies and stay because they find in African American studies this tradition of critique, of resistance, and of protest, right, to systems of oppression that so much of the world ignores, right? they find in our classes this kind of refreshing recognition of the dominance of white supremacy and anti-blackness and colonialism and the ways that they shape our world that are so often ignored, right? And so that's, you know, what I think draws a lot of our students to our classes, maybe even what keeps a lot of our students in our classes. And yet, you know, in your book, you're offering an important critique of the dominance of the resistance paradigm, as you call it. And you're drawing on the works of other scholars as well who really want to challenge this assumption that the end-all be-all of African-American life and living is resistance, right? That we always have to read African-American history through the lens of resistance. I'm thinking especially about your chapters on protest and the blues, where you kind of push us to kind of move beyond thinking that protest is just a synonym for the civil rights movement or a social movement. So I'd love to hear you reflect a little bit on why you think it's important to challenge this dominant paradigm and how challenging it kind of invites us to reframe how we think of African-American life.
Yeah, I think that the kind of focus on protest has to also be historically situated. So within U.S. society and within academia, there for a very long time was a truly distorted narrative about Black life. It focused on Black docility. It was one that kind of played up the Sambo or other kind of caricatures of Blackness that denied resistance existing.
Right.
It was one that criticized African Americans for not having the same forms of resistance that you saw in places like Haiti or in Jamaica, which had, again, also much larger Black populations percentage-wise than the United States. And so the focus on resistance was initially, especially like in the 1960s, let's say, in academia and also in, you know, our social movements, was a reflection of a desire to show that, no, people are not okay with Jim Crow. No, people were not okay with slavery. No, people are not okay with oppression, and therefore we have to do something about it. So that's where a lot of that is coming from, and I think that's where a lot of the students are also coming from, is that they have seen an absence of really talking about not just the fact of the injustice, but what we should do about it. And that's what I do agree, you know, the students come to our classes to learn about. I also want, however, my students to appreciate that Black people's lives are not just about suffering or resistance. That there are so many other facets and nuances of Black culture and kind of Black communities that don't have to do with what white people are doing to you, right? And so I wanted to leave room for, in the book, and I hope I do this in my courses too, to think about what it means to have a fuller understanding of Black life that's not simply reactive to white supremacy. And so I think that it's important to then, on the one hand, have a broader definition of protest and not just think about, you know, people in the streets protesting in marches or just people boycotting or people making political speeches, but to also think about it in some of the everyday ways that people resist, and even resistance through or protest through mourning, right? Affirming the value of the person who has you have lost is a form of protest, even though it's not public. It's not directed at white people. It is directed within, right, within the community and to yourself. But I also think, again, like the book is about a kind of beauty and grace that can't be reduced to just what white supremacy forced to be created. And that's also just an important lesson for all of us to be reminded of when we're thinking about Black people's lives. There aren't only two stories. It's not only suffering or resistance. Right. There are so many more things we should be talking about, even in a book about lynching.
That's right. That's right. Well, I mean, and I actually think that this dovetails perfectly with my last question, which again is the question for me, because, you know, we began this conversation talking about your opening sentence, right, your opening paragraph, and about how you kind of invite us into this conversation on the trauma of lynching through the artist, right? Through beauty, through pleasure. And there are countless poets, novelists, musicians that you're quoting throughout your book. In other words, like artists are all over the pages. But one artist in particular who you and I, you know, adore and have learned so much from is James Baldwin, right? Baldwin looms very large. He's there in chapter epigraphs. He's there in quotes. But of course, he's, you know, if your first sentence is "the artist has much to offer the scholar," the first words that anyone will read are actually Baldwin's. The title of your book comes from a Baldwin quote, as you note. You know, the quote is, "My memory stammers, but my soul is a witness." And so, you know, I actually think you're probably touching on this a little bit in that last answer, but I was wondering if you could reflect kind of as a final question on what insights Baldwin offers you in particular, you know, why his voice is so singular, you know, which is not to say that like over and against other artists, but there seems to be a particular thing or set of things or way of saying things and thinking about, you know, race and violence and memory and trauma and the blues and these things, and just like what it means to be human, that Baldwin offers you. And so I just, you know, your title opens with Baldwin, and so maybe we can, it's fitting that we close with him as well. So
yeah, we're actually right now I'm teaching a seminar on Baldwin, which I will be teaching next spring if any students are interested in taking it. And he's someone who was a real seer. You know, he wrote in the middle of the 20th century, late 20th century, but has written things that very much speak to the present and continue to speak to the present. And he's also someone who's alive during a lot of the period that my book is about. And I think both of those things make him such an important thinker for me to think with and through. The idea for the book came in many ways from him. I read a short story called Going to Meet the Man, which is about a white deputy sheriff in the South who is made to feel something has changed because of the civil rights movement. And to reassure himself of his place as a white man in the South goes back to this memory of a lynching that he attended as a child. And so even though my book is not about white Southerners, although they are in chapter four and in parts of chapter two too, it's really a book that is thinking about memory. How does that memory continue to shape who we are, and how do we go return to memories as a way of kind of positioning ourselves? And so it was through his short story that I came to ask the scholarly question about the afterlife of lynching for Black Southerners. And also, in part through his and others' work on the blues, that got me to thinking about the centrality of the sensibility of the blues in understanding Black responses to trauma. And his essay, The Uses of the Blues, does a really beautiful job of articulating what it is that the blues are about, right? You know, life is hard. You will suffer. There's no way around that. But you have to make a way for yourself to get through that. And that's what that sensibility is, right? And it's one that he thinks that is often not a part of the more general American consciousness, right? We try to avoid thoughts of suffering and death and try to live in like this happy place without the reality that life does involve suffering. And we have to still find a way, even though it seems impossible, to get through it. And so there's so many of these kinds of insights from Baldwin. I love what he can do with language. I can't do what he does with language. I don't think anyone can. But I do appreciate what he can do with language. And for me, he's always been the model for what it means to be a good writer, a good thinker. And as he would say, a good man too.
Yeah. And I think that if I can say one last thing about your book is that you know, this thing that I keep saying over and over again about the kind of the beauty and poetry of your book on this kind of horrifying subject is very Baldwinian in that sense. I think that he, you know, has this gift of kind of making life come alive in words, and you've done that as well here. So I'm grateful for you. I'm grateful for this beautiful and brilliant book. And I'd encourage everyone, again, listening to really pick it up and discover it for yourself. This book is My Soul is a Witness, The Traumatic Afterlife of Lynching. Thank you so much, Mari.
Thank you for having me. This is a great conversation.
So thank you for listening to this episode of Speaking of College of Charleston with today's guest, Professor Mari Crabtree. For more episodes and to read stories about our guests, visit the College of Charleston's official news site, The College Today, at today.cofc.edu. You can also find episodes on all major podcast platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher. If you like what you hear, please subscribe and leave a review. This episode was produced by Amy Stockwell from the Office of Marketing and Communications, with recording and sound engineering by Jesse Kunz from the Division of Information Technology. Thanks again, and we'll see you next time.